maybe open it up for a few questions, if anybody has any questions that they'd like to ask. Yes?
Were you going to tell us how you became a monk?
Was I?
Yes.
Well, I became a monk. I stumbled into it and realized I'd stumbled into something good. So I was... I started reading books on Buddhism when I was at school at university, and then I finished and then went off. As I said, I grew up in a small town in Canada, and I wanted to get as far away as I could possibly could. So I went off traveling, and those were the days when you could still backpack and travel overland through Middle East and Asia, and I ended up in Thailand. Didn't even know it was a Buddhist country. And I got there, and it was, wow, this is different. I like this. I'm gonna stay here for a while. And of course, the prominent thing that was different was there's monasteries everywhere. So I thought, well, maybe I'll go study in a monastery and see if I can. Because I wanted to learn about meditation. I hadn't ever done that. And so I went to monastery to learn meditation, which I did, and I practiced to some extent. And then one of the monks who was there, because Thais are very friendly, very open, and very, and so they just sort of said, "Why don't you ordain as a monk?" And I said, "Oh, I don't think I could do that. I mean, I couldn't live like this for the rest of my life. I mean, who could do that?" And they sort of looked at me with this, you know, puzzled look, and said, "I was like, no, I mean, you don't have to ordain for the rest of your life. And it's just ordinary for us to ordain for short periods of time. 3 or 4 months is going to... 3 or 4 months, I could do that. That would be a good experience." So I did. But I kept extending my time. It's coming up 40 years now. Yes.
So I was wondering, in the reality of spiritual friendship, or looking at that and trying to change some friendships, letting go of some people and going forward to people you want to emulate.
Yeah.
It seems to be, for me, it's not so easy. There's a lot of difficulty. There's difficulty in letting go of people who have been in my life forever, feeling guilty that I shouldn't do that. Part of me admires those people who have the same people in their life forever and ever. I don't mean just family, but you know, I mean family is stuff. But you know, finding the new friendships. With people who have those characteristics that you're looking for, why would they want to be with you? I mean, they're up there and you're here. And, you know, I mean, this is what I'm saying.
Well, I think that's the... No, I think that's really a conundrum that we all face.
Can you repeat the comments? Repeat what he said a little bit.
Okay. Well, I think the gist of it is the concern and in terms of it's not so easy to just to shift friendships. I mean, you can't make if friends disappear, and there's connections, and one has over time, so that those are sometimes those friendships are enduring, and how to deal with those situations. Is that correct? So that I think one of the things is it isn't done in a judgmental way, but the reality is that once one commits to a certain qualities and certain standards of conduct that you see beneficial, then there'll be those people in one's sphere of friendship who find that actually encouraging and inspiring, and are on board, and there'll be those who think it's just they're totally weirded out by it, and I think quite naturally, without trying to pick and choose and be forceful about it, or to preach about it, that friendships they tend to gravitate naturally, so that to allow that to be a natural gravitation, so that, say, like myself as a monk, I've been in the robes for a long time, but I still have friendships that go back to my childhood. And they're certainly not living as monks or even as Buddhists. But they're good people who appreciate what I'm doing and what my life stands for. And others have drifted away. But it's, you know, again, it's quite natural. So that I think that sense of allowing it to be a natural process is important, because oftentimes, you know, one really can't trust one's own views and opinions at the time. I see that with say people who come into the monastery, take ordination, and they get incredibly fired up and inspired and write these long tracts of spiritual epistles that trying to enlighten their friends and family. I mean, it's a real pain in the butt sometimes. you've got somebody like that in your sphere of friendship. It's really it's kind of hard. So that I think in terms of spiritual friendship, one really wants to friends that kind of spiritual friendship is something that grows kind of naturally and slowly, and even one's own views and opinions are sometimes not to be trusted so much of either, in terms of because there's something really offensive about people who get up on their spiritual pulpit and start preaching, so that it's a good way to lose friends. But it's so that sense of really letting that be natural and seeing how those friendships pan out over time. Okay.
I just want to say that was very helpful.
Oh, good, good, good.
I could see some of the neurotic or negative stuff I was.
Yeah, and especially with some friendships, you realize, gee, it's really, you know, I really don't want to go there anymore. You know, it's just not comfortable. The heart isn't there, and it's some kind of the social engagements and, you know, complications. And so, no, I don't want to go there anymore. Yeah.
You mentioned that you thought maybe a better word for wisdom was discernment.
Yeah.
Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I think in terms of, especially with the roots of the word in the scriptural language, wisdom in the English language almost tends to be something quite static and you know, either you've got wisdom or you don't. It's like a piece of knowledge or illumination or something that's there that's you know, quite solid. And but discernment, there's an active engagement in the act of knowing and understanding, and that's where the root of Pali the word Panya is oftentimes translated as wisdom, but it comes from the root pajanati, which is to know and to understand. So that discernment is probably a better expression of that the word that the Buddha used, and what he's trying to get us to do, like to get us to know and understand, rather than seek that kind of bit of wisdom that we can hang on to. Okay, one more.
Is there something we can do, for example, if we have like a sister or something that has association with unwholesome friendship?
Mm-hmm.
Well, how can we help these individuals to redirect them?
Especially if it's within the family, then, I mean, you've already got a foundation, or hopefully, already have a foundation of association and concern, so that and it's important to again not to be preaching, but to be out of an expression of concern. One can be sort of trying to articulate a sense of hope that they, you know, might look at things in a different way. But it has to be put in, you can't just sort of, again, this sort of preaching to them or trying to force them, because that just, people push back to that. But when it's a genuine expression of concern, oftentimes people will, even if there's an initial reaction, if you keep your intention really clear and have that sense of concern and to express that as gently or in as clearly as one can, oftentimes that the response is very positive. This just happened a good example just happened at the monastery where one of the monks' fathers was. There were some things that he was concerned about, and so he had his older brother speak with his father with this concern. So rather than him doing it, sort of finding, okay, so the older brother has got a bit more street creds in the family, have his older brother bring it up, and as a expression of concern, and the whole family was really relieved that the father heard it and took it on, so a lot of it is clarifying intention. And then when one does approach somebody, that you really want to be careful and attentive that, say, it's executed with concern and care. Okay, so maybe we can have a bit of a break in terms of continuing our meditation, but doing walking meditation. Especially in the our tradition, Thai Forest tradition, walking meditation plays a big part in our continuity of practice of meditation, so sitting meditation, walking meditation, so that there's lots of areas that are flat here. There's the meadow area, there's little roads, there's the parking area. So people want to go out and find a flat spot, 10, 20, 15, 20, 25 paces, whatever works for one. And then walking meditation, you want to, it's an opportunity to compose. In the same way that when you sit meditation, you're composing your body in a sitting position. For walking meditation, you'll compose your body, clasping the hands in front, keeping the eyes cast down about 6-8 feet in front of one, and then walking a bit slower than normal. It doesn't have to be painfully slow, comfortably slow, so that you're really slowing, not just slowing the body down, slowing the whole mental processes down at the same time. You're just walking slowly, being attentive to the sensation of the body, the sensation of touch, the touching the ground, lifting one's right foot, paying attention to that, setting it down, and bringing the attention to that left foot, bringing it down. In being comfortable in the body with the that rhythm of the, basically the arising and passing away of the footsteps, and just each, the right foot, the left foot, being grounded in the body, relaxing, settling, if somebody, well, maybe one of us will get to, we can ring a bell at about half an hour, and we can come in for another sit.